The book of Deuteronomy, chapter 21. As you know, Moses is delivering a farewell oration. An important message. A powerful sermon. The people of Israel are being prepared to cross over the Jordan River and go into the land of promise. And so Moses is reminding them of what was already told to them. He is reiterating and repeating and reminding to a great degree of the things that they had already heard from Moses previously. But like any football coach in the locker room before they charge out on the field for the opening kickoff of the big game, the coach will once again go over the game plan that he's been working on with them all week long previously. And that's what this is, in a very real sense. Coach Moses, knowing that his team is going to charge out of the locker room, go out onto the field, into the promised land, is giving them some exhortations and some instructions, reminding them of certain truths, underscoring certain things that they might be successful in the land of promise. That's the intention of Moses. It's the intention of our Father. He wants you and desires for me to be successful and fruitful, both in this life and eternally. And so Moses talks here about maturity and responsibility. He says in verse 1 of chapter 21, "If one be found slain in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess, lying in the field, and it be not known who hath slain him, then thy elders and thy judges shall come forth, and they shall measure unto the cities which are round about him that is slain. And it shall be that the city which is closest to the slain man, even the elders of that city shall take a heifer." Verse 4 goes on to say, "And they shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the valley." Verse 6 says, "And all the elders of that city that are next to the slain man, the carcass, the body, they shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley. And they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. So be merciful, O Lord, unto thy people Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, and lay not innocent blood unto thy people of Israel's charge, and the blood shall be forgiven them." When they're in the promised land, there are going to be difficulties and deaths. Deaths that are not solved, that is, murders or deaths that are not explained. And it's not as though God's people are to say, well, we don't know how that guy died. We're not sure what happened to him. We don't know who killed that fella. So whatever. But rather, they are to measure where the carcass is from to the closest city. And the elders that are in that closest city are to come out and chop off the head of a heifer and wash their hands and make intercession for the area, for the region. And in this we see something that's very important. The elders in the city, like the elders of this church, or the elders in your home, your family, or the elders on the job site, with maturity, and that's what elders are, they're supposed to be mature men, whether it's the father in a home, or the elders at a church, or the bosses on the job site. An elder is to be a man of maturity, and if he is indeed that, maturity means that you assume responsibility. You can't just say, well, you know, there's a dead guy over there, and somebody else is going to have to deal with that, or somebody else is going to have to figure out what ought to be done. That's not my responsibility. It's not my obligation. There comes a point in a man's life, in a woman's life, when a person says, you know what? It's time that I take responsibility, even though it's not my problem per se. It's time that I deal with issues, even though it's not my obligation actually. I was talking to the staff over at Lake Bradley yesterday afternoon, and we were talking about assuming responsibilities, and it was raining real hard over there, and it was actually hailing on the coast. And it's really cool because we have these new metal roofs on a lot of the buildings. And so when the hail comes down, it's pretty impressive. It's like, bam, 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 bam. You know, it's like you're in this tin drum. And I was saying, you know, there's a roof right now over our heads that is assuming or absorbing, I should say, those pounding hailstones coming down in our direction. And the roof is reflecting it and absorbing it and deflecting it and all those things so that you and I can sit here and have this conversation. But the roof has taken the pound and the roof has taken the beating. And I said, that's what we get to do now, as I was talking to those leaders over there. That's what we get to do. We get to be the roof, the covering, so people can come over here to Lake Bradley and just enjoy the facility and seek the Lord and take in the Bible studies. But in any organization or any community, there needs to be some people of maturity who are going to act as a covering when all hail breaks out, so to speak. And poundings come down and the heat is turned up, that there's a roof that deflects the hail or absorbs the heat so that people that are in the room can just conversate or whatever they might be up to without being distracted by the weather out there. That's the idea here. God is saying when you get to the promised land and there's some problem, there's a death that's unsolved or inexplicable or whatever it might be, there needs to be some men. The closest city needs to have the men of maturity come out and say, we're going to assume the obligation of dealing with this situation. A sacrifice is made, intercession is offered, and the people then in that region will be protected, sheltered, and covered, you see. If you have an opportunity to serve as an elder, on the job, in the church, with the family, whatever it might be, hey, realize that's part of the beautiful, privileged responsibilities that God gives to a person when they've moved into a certain degree of maturity. I can take the heat. I'll take the hail. I'll take the pounding so that others can do what I got to do for years. And that's sit in the pew or not worry about the certain issues on the job site or worry about paying the power bill at home. Whatever application you make for this, you see, we got to be those that just sat and took in and enjoyed our homes or jobs or church or whatever it might be. But there comes a point when you have to say, you know what? I'm getting older now. I've got some maturity and I'm ready to be a covering, to be a roof for others to enjoy now, even as I've enjoyed for so many years previously. God says these guys are to take the responsibility of dealing with that dead body, that difficult stuff, that stinky corpse, whatever it might be, so that the whole community might be sheltered. They were to offer sacrifice, and they were to plead mercy, and they were to be engaged intercessorily. Same thing's true for you, for me. As we move into maturity, with maturity comes responsibility. That's just the way it is. And when, verse 10, you go to war against your enemies, and you will. Just like there'll be dead bodies that have to be dealt with, there's also going to be enemies that have to be fought against. And when you go to war against these enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you have taken them captive, and you see among the captives, verse 11, a beautiful woman, and hast a desire unto her that thou wouldest have her to thy wife, then thou shalt bring her home to thine house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails, or as your margin says, allow the nails to grow. And she shall put off the raiment of her captivity, the clothes that she wore previously. And she shall remain in your house and bewail her father and her mother for a full month. And afterward thou shalt go in unto her and be her husband, and she shall be thy wife. And it shall be, if thou have no delight in her, then thou shalt let her go wherever she wants, but you shall not sell her at all for money. Thou shalt not make merchandise of her, because thou hast humbled her. Now keep in mind, in every culture at this time in history, and throughout the history of the world until relatively recently, when there was a war, the soldiers in that war would be able to wreak havoc upon the populace, especially the women of the cities or regions that they conquered. The Lord here, in a shocking way, if we lived back then in those times, is saying, no longer applicable. You can't ravish the women. You can't do what you want to when you conquer a city or conquer a region. In fact, if you see a woman that interests you, you can take her to be your wife, but here's what you must do. You don't touch her. You bring her home and you shave her hair, and she grows her nails. Now, in those days, the growing of nails was considered to be, not like it is in our day, a thing of beauty, but an oddity, a bizarrity. Long nails would be like, ooh. And you shave her hair. And she takes off whatever clothes that she was wearing, and she puts on mourning clothes, probably sackcloth. And she bewails her mom and dad, who were either killed in the battle or left behind. She bewails them for 1 month. And then if you still want her, after hearing her wail for a month, and her hair is shaved off, and her nails are real long and dirty, you see, and the beauty's no longer there, the dress that she wore is no longer on her, the hair is shaved off her, the nails are grown long, you know, sticking out with dirt underneath them or whatever it might be. And she's wailing and moaning day after day, week after week, for a month in totality. If you still want her, okay, you can have her. She is going to be your wife. But if you don't delight in her, if there's something wrong, if it's just not going to work, let her go. You are not to enslave her, or you are not to sell her into prostitution. If she doesn't delight you, if there's a problem after that month long, you then take her as your wife, but it doesn't work out, you let her go. And she is absolutely and totally free. Now in this, there's a lesson for us, I think, too, and for our kids that are single particularly. And that is, hey, there's wars going on, truly. There's wars without, and there's battles within. Hormones rage, and kids say, man, I just gotta have her, or I gotta get married right away. I talk to some people sometimes, and they'll say something like this: John, I'm getting married. And I'll say, great, when? Next week. You are? Wow. How long have you known her? For 2 weeks, and we're getting married. And I said, whoa, slow down. You know, slow down. Love is patient. See? And if you're really in love, your relationship can stand and it will pass the test of time. You don't need to rush out and get married and take her to be your wife. Yeah, but man, there's this raging war within me, the hormones and the feelings and all of that, you see. I understand. But the fact of the matter is, God here is declaring, even in the heat of a battle, in the place of war, slow down. I know that when you're on the battlefield, in this case, the Lord would say in our text here before us today, I know that you think, oh, I've got to have her, or she's a real beauty. Stop, slow down, take it easy. That's the message for us too. Slow down, think it through, take her slow. If you're really in love, if it's really of God, hey, that relationship will stand the test of waiting for a season. Remember what was said by, oh my goodness, my mind is blank. He worked for her for 7 years, and they seemed but to him but a few days. Jacob, of course. He worked 7 years, and it seemed to him but a few days. Because it says in Genesis of the great love that he had for her. See, love is patient. Be that as it may, God here declares, if you see her, fine, bring her back home, shave her hair off, let her nails grow, listen to her wailing for a month, and then if you still want her, okay. Now, if a man, verse 15, have two wives, one beloved and the other hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, it shall be, verse 16, when he makes his sons to inherit, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before or over the son of the hated, which is indeed truly the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. If you have two wives, and one's loved and one's hated, and by the way, that's the problem of polygamy. See, polygamy was a fact in those days at that time of history. Now, as we've talked about, as the word unfolds, God will move his family, move his people away from this practice of polygamy. But at this time, he's putting restrictions around it. He's giving regulations relating to it. He will eventually wean them from it. But in the Old Testament, here in the early part of the Old Testament, they do have multiple wives, and they would for a season. And God says, here's the reality. You have two wives. One's loved and the other's hated. And by the way, that's the way it always is. It's part of the reason why God hates divorce is because there is no final decree in divorce. The hatred and the bitterness and the problems, if you've been through the heartbreak and heartache of a divorce, you know the reality of this. It never goes away. There's always repercussions and difficulties and problems. Oh, praise the Lord for the blood of His Son that washes away our failings and sins and makes all things new within. But nonetheless, practically, there's always repercussions. And that's why polygamy is impractical, because you can't serve two masters, Jesus said. You'll love one and you'll hate the other. No matter how much you try to love both, it's not a real human possibility. You can't serve two masters. You'll love one and hate the other, or you'll hate the one and love the other. Now, when this happens, and you have kids from both wives, be careful that you don't say, well, my favorite wife here, the one I love, she's had a son now too. My wife that I don't like anymore, or my wife that I hate right now, well, we had a son too, and he's older, but I'm just gonna now make this son of my favorite wife the firstborn. God said, don't you dare do that. Your firstborn is your firstborn. Let me talk to you who have gone through the heartache of divorce. You mustn't forget about, ignore your firstborn. Even if your firstborn is no longer in the house, as far as you're married to a different spouse, I have seen, you have seen, we know of when there's a new family, sometimes sad to say, heartbreakingly and tragically, the firstborn is just forgotten. Like he or she never existed. And I'm talking with some kids right now, presently, who can't understand why dad or why mom has completely forgotten about them. Because now dad has a new family. And the firstborn is just completely ignored. It's as though he never lived. And I'm talking to a young man right now, and my heart goes out to him because he can't understand. And I said, well, it's just, you know what happens when families split up and divorces take place. And I'm trying to help him to see, but this young man who's now 22. He just can't get over the hump. He doesn't understand why he's been forgotten and ignored, because now his dad has new children with his new wife. And all that's to say, not a word of condemnation, but a word of evaluation for those who have gone through different family situations. You mustn't forget your firstborn. Yeah, but I hate that wife now. Don't forget your firstborn. I hate that husband now. Don't forget your firstborn. God's word here, God's heart is, please, you don't change the inheritance. You don't suddenly say, well, now the son of my beloved wife is going to be my pride and joy. God says, it's not to be that way. But you are not to forget about your firstborn. He is the strength of your inheritance, and the right to be in that position is his. And if your new wife or your new husband doesn't understand that, you need to communicate to them from this passage, honey, or sweetie, or dear, or whatever you call your husband or wife or whatever it might be, we have a moral obligation and a biblical exhortation to not forget about my firstborn or your firstborn. Very important. Divorce does happen. We live in a society, in a culture where we're fallen people, and divorce does happen. But let's not complicate an already complicated situation by ignoring the firstborn. That's what God is saying here. Now, if a man have a rebellious son, and he's stubborn too, verse 18, which will not obey the voice of his father, nor the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him, he won't hearken to them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him out to the elders of the city, to the gate of that place. That's where the elder sat, was in the gate. We've talked about that previously. And they shall say to the elders of the city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. That is, he is a partier. Our son, he doesn't listen to us. He's a party animal. He doesn't do what we tell him to. They are required to bring him to the elders of the city. That's a demand. It's a command. Not an option or a possibility. The law, the Torah says that they are to actually bring that son. They're obligated to do so, to bring that son to the elders of the city. And the elders then are to hear the story. And then all, verse 21, all the men of the city shall stone that rebellious son with stones that he die. And this evil will be put away from among you, for all Israel shall hear and fear. In the last days, Paul tells us that one of the signs of the end times will be that people, children, are disobedient to parents. They're rebellious. They don't receive discipline or instruction. We're seeing that happen. In these days, Bible times, in Moses' exhortation, in the giving of the Torah and the law concerning those situations, it was radical. You take the son and all the men of the city pick up rocks and stone him. Why? Several reasons. First of all, it would be a motivation. Motivation? If all the men, every man in the community was throwing rocks at that son, they all know his name. They all watched him grow up. They all care about the families that are there. And now they're throwing rocks. They're hurling rocks at that son, at that boy, at that young man. Every one of those dads is going to go home, believe you me, and work on properly raising their sons, lest their sons end up in the same place of pain and death. It's motivation. Two, it's evaluation. That's why all the men were to participate, that each man might evaluate, that each man might say, I wonder if I could have done something. Even though he's not my son directly, he's in our community. He's in our communal family. And could I have done something to help him not be incorrigible, not be in rebellion? And each man would leave that stoning asking that question, could I have done something, and will I then do something when I see the situation happen with some other young man in the community later on again? Interesting. It would be sobering. I can't imagine what it would be like to stone one of the kids in the neighborhood. It would make me, like I say, make sure that Benny was behaving properly. And it would make me ask myself soberly, could I have done something to help this kid instead of now being the one to throw rocks at this kid? And it was a proclamation. Not only was it, you know, that to be a motivation to raise their sons and an evaluation, did I really do what I could have done to help that kid through those times? But it's a proclamation. Rebellion is not to be tolerated. A proclamation saying it's not okay to be rebellious. It's not just part of growing up necessarily. God has a different view on that. He expects His people to not tolerate sin in the family, but to do whatever it takes. And I want to say this just kind of parenthetically. I said it last night. I wasn't sure I was going to say it tonight, but here I am again. So I guess I will. But you know, it's funny because in these days, in our times, we as parents, I think, are increasingly of the attitude of, well, that's just part of growing up. To do drugs or to drink stuff or be going to parties, that's just kind of growing up. Maybe in the world, but it ought not to be in God's family. Now, I know that it happens. And we've talked about that because a child is rebellious, it doesn't necessarily mean that mom or dad or mom and dad drop the ball. Because some kids are just flat out plain old rebellious and incorrigible. It doesn't mean that mom and dad failed necessarily any more than God failed when His firstborn, if you would, Adam, when God made Adam, Adam rebelled against God. And God didn't fail as a parent, believe me. He didn't say, oh, I could have done better. He didn't say, oh, I should have had, I should have done. God is the perfect Father, but Adam rebelled against Him. Lucifer, his right-hand man, if you would, in the organization of heaven, in a sense, the worship leader, rebelled against Him. Doesn't mean that he was a bad parent to Lucifer. Jesus had Judas, and Judas betrayed Jesus. It doesn't mean that, hey, Jesus should have or could have done more or should have done better. There are people that are just going to be prone towards rebellion. It's true. So moms and dads need to be careful that they don't beat themselves up when a child or children rebel. Because the Father Himself went through that. His Son, Jesus Christ, experienced it. On the other side of the coin, there are things that the Bible tells us that we ought to do and get to do and got to do to help our kids to not be rebellious and wild. And I suggest, and here I go, that it starts even when kids are little. And so if you're a newer parent, or if you're not yet a parent, begin to lovingly but firmly discipline your kids constantly with love but firmness. Don't let them run wild when they're little guys. I've been amazed recently, kind of frankly, I'm out on thin ice here, but I've been amazed at what kids do in the sanctuary after services and before services. Watching kids jump on the pews and run up here and jump off, and mom and dad are just talking over here or back there, and kids are running wild. And I think, they're saying, how do you know? We have cameras in here. And we see back there what goes on. My point is that I think, do moms and dads, have they lost the understanding that discipline starts when you're little? And if your kids are just running all over the place and jumping on stuff, you wouldn't let your kids go to a house of a neighbor or a friend and jump on the couch and pound on the piano and run through the flowers? I hope you wouldn't do that. Maybe you would, but you ought not to. But I watch kids and they just run wild. And I think, this is not the way it's supposed to be. If they're running wild in church, where else are they running wild? And when will mom and dad say, that's not proper behavior, sweetie? Son, we don't do that. If you want to jump, you jump outside and not in the flowers. There's places to jump and there's places to run. And there's places to behave and respect other people's property. See? And I say that because I'm not sure that younger parents today understand that rebelliousness starts to manifest itself, running wild starts to manifest itself when kids are real little. And if you don't nip it in the bud then, they'll run wild in bigger ways later on. And you'll say, what happened? How did my son get this way? And it may be that maybe he was never instructed properly when he was 2 or 3. Because mom and dad were too busy praying, I guess, or talking about the Bible while their kids were running wild. It ought not to be. Ouch. I know I'm on thin ice, but, you know, one person. But be that as it may. No, if you're saying, oh, man, I'm guilty. Just think it through and give it consideration. Got it, John. I need to start working on my kids now. Now, listen, I need to start working on my kids now so they don't get stoned later. Because that's what happens. You know, why is my son doing pot? You know, why is he out partying and getting drunk? Why is he stoned? Because you didn't deal with it perhaps when he was younger. See, it's an important thing. I'm a firm believer in a loving discipline. You discipline your kids when they're young. Not beat them, but you discipline them firmly. You expect the best out of them. You demand it. Otherwise, they'll get stoned later on, guarantee. Well, be that as it may, they were to take these sons that were rebellious and incorrigible out of the city and stone them. And interesting, because when you think this through, you can't help but think of what Jesus talked on and talked about that day in Luke's gospel, Luke chapter 15, when he told a story. There was a rebellious son who was in the city giving himself to wine and women, blowing the father's inheritance that the fathers gave to him so generously. And then this rebellious son came back home, back towards the city again. The story, of course, is well known to you, the story of the prodigal son. You know what happened? Jesus was telling the story. It's a shocker. There's a punchline. It's a kicker. Because the father runs out, not with rocks in his hands, but runs out to greet that young man. And I suggest to you that he ran out to protect the son from being stoned according to the law. And Jesus talked about in that radical story, you mean this son that was rebellious and stubborn and a glutton, the very things that Torah, that the law talks about, you mean the father ran out to protect him and kill a fatted calf for him and love on him? Yes, because we are the rebellious sons, all of us. We've rebelled against our father. We've jumped off the stage, so to speak, over and over. We've been rebellious. But the good news is our Father runs out not with rocks to throw on us, but with arms to wrap around us. I'm so thankful for that. Well, wait a minute. So did God change his mind? When Jesus told that story about the prodigal son, that's against Torah teaching. That's against the law, against Deuteronomy chapter 21. Wait a minute. Take a look at the next two verses. If a man commit a sin worthy of death, which they just talked about a sin worthy of death, which is being a rebellious son, and he be put to death and hang on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day. For he that is hanged on a tree is accursed of God, that thy land be not defiled. This verse, verse 23, is quoted in Galatians chapter 3, verse 13. And it was fulfilled according to Galatians 3:13, in the one son who was never rebellious, who hung on a tree and was cursed. He took your curse, my curse, our sin, and he died in our place. See, this is the beautiful thing. That's why, although I deserve to be put to death and stoned, I've been rebellious and stubborn against my Father in heaven. But my Father in heaven sent his only begotten Son, Jesus Christ, the one who never rebelled, who said, I always do the things that please the Father. And the Son hung on the tree and was made a curse for me, that now I might be forgiven and I might experience that grace and mercy of the Father wrapping his arms around me, killing the fatted calf for me. I love this. So the story of the prodigal son, Luke 15, for you Bible students, it fits in right to this section talking about the rebellious son, what the law demanded. But wait, also when there was a sin worthy of death, if a man was hung on a tree, a cross, that man was cursed. And that's what Jesus did for you, for me, for all of us who have been rebellious. He died in our place. I'm grateful for that. Now, if you see thy brother's ox or his sheep go astray, hide yourself from them. Thou shalt in any case bring them again to thy brother. If you see, verse 4, your brother's ass or his ox fall down by the way and hide yourself from them, thou shalt surely help him to lift them up again. If you see your brother's donkey or cow or whatever on the side of the road in a ditch, maybe an explorer or a ranchero or a tracker or a Volkswagen or whatever it might be, you're not to say, well, I'm going to, you know, ignore that, but you're to help. I'm to help. We're to help our brother and take again responsibility. That's the idea here. If I don't, it's a sin. See, there are sins of commission, that is when I do something wrong, and sins of omission, when I don't do what's right. James chapter 5, verse 14 says, he that knows to do right and does it not, it is sin. So there are things that I can do. I can do misdeeds, you know, misdeeds, wrong stuff, or I can miss deeds that I ought to do, good deeds. So there's misdeeds and there's missed deeds. There's sins of commission, where I do something wrong, and omission, where I don't do what I know is just plain old the right thing to do. And that's the idea here. If your brother's thing is stuck, his ox, his sheep, his axe gone astray or stuck in a ditch or whatever it might be, help him out. And women, verse 5, you are not to wear that which pertains unto a man, nor men, you're not to wear a woman's garment, for all that do so are an abomination to the Lord. You know, obviously dealing with the issue of cross-dressing and perversity in that way, I'm going to share something here that, again, you may not agree with, and that's okay. But I have noticed increasingly in news magazines and newspapers, celebrities in humor dressing up like the opposite sex. Matt Lauer yesterday or a couple of days ago dressed like some, you know, famous actress or singer or something in a very, you know, mocking, sensual kind of way, risque way. And I think, you know, I don't think that that ought to be humorized personally. It might sound prudish, but I do not think it's something which we ought to veer off into at all, even in those kinds of ways, because you see, it's too close to reality. Too many people are all mixed up and messed up about sexual identity. God knows the evil that's in the hearts of people. And so he says, don't go there at all. Just don't do it. And so he puts a prohibition here against even putting on garments that are men's garments if you're a woman, or women's garments if you're a man, and all of the rest. And then if you see a bird's nest, verse 6, on the ground or in a tree, and there be young ones or eggs in the nest with the dam, with the mama, you are not to take the mother bird with the young, or you're not to take the mother bird and the eggs, but you are to let, verse 7, the mother bird go. Then you can take the young or the eggs to you. And this will make it well with thee, and you will prolong your days. A little word on ecology, on environmental responsibility. As I said on Sunday, if you were here for that study, this goes against the grain of my own personality. I have a tendency to say, hey, a bird and eggs in the nest on the ground right here. Man, fried bird and scrambled eggs. But God would say, time out, foul. That's not to be, pardon me. That was a bad yoke. But not to be, don't do that. Don't do that. There's to be some sensitivity. You can have the eggs, but you got to let the mama go free. And God does want us to take responsibility and be concerned about things like this. The environment and nature and all the rest. And not just that, but the next verse talks about building codes. When you build a new house, thou shalt make a battlement, a railing for thy roof, that thou bring not blood upon thine house if any man fall from thence. When you build a house, you put a railing around the roof, lest somebody fall off and get hurt. Now in those days, of course, the roofs were flat and people used the roofs as patios. You would go up to the roof. Remember in Acts chapter 10, Peter was on the roof at the house of Cornelius. When he had that vision, the sheet came down and he saw unclean meat on the sheet. And God said, eat the meat. And Peter said, no way, that's uncool, unkosher, unclean. God said, don't you call Peter unclean what I have declared to be clean. All that took place on a rooftop. The point is, when you have this roof, you put a railing around that roof so that people won't fall off the roof and get hurt. See, my tendency in my flesh is to say, if they're up on my roof, man, that's their problem. And they've got to take some responsibility themselves. That's my tendency. But God would say, John, that might be your tendency, but it's not my heart. I want you to be concerned about and careful about and working for the welfare and well-being of others, even though it might put you out or be regulatory or bureaucratic. And this convicts me a whole bunch. But there is to be a railing around the roof. This is building code stuff. So you have the building code beginning in verse 8, and you have the Environmental Protection Agency in verses 6 and 7. God is concerned about these kinds of things, and so I guess ought to we be concerned about such things as well. Watch out, verse 9, 10, and 11 says that you don't get involved in mixture where you sow different kinds of seeds together, or you plow, verse 10, an ox and an ass in the same yoke or same harness. Don't wear different materials in the same garment, that is, of wool and linen. All of these are examples and pictures of mixture. Don't be involved in mixture. That's a theme of the scriptures that we'll see over and over. What's mixture? Being, you know, spiritual on Sunday and carnal on Monday and spiritual on Thursday and partying on Friday. Mixture. You're mixed up. We're mixing things together. Spiritual life and carnal stuff. Jesus said, either be hot or he said, be cold. Do not be lukewarm. What's lukewarm? It's a mixture. It's hot water and cold water mixed. And Jesus said, lukewarm, I spew out of my mouth. I like hot tea. I love iced tea. But room temperature tea, it just doesn't do anything for me. So consequently, this is one of those examples, and I wish we could explore it more, but we'll have to let it go right there for right now. God is declaring and simply saying, don't get involved in mixture. Be this way or be that way. Be hot, I'll use you. Be cold, I'll break you. But don't be mixture, because you'll be miserable. You'll have too much of the world to enjoy the Lord, and you'll have too much of the Lord to enjoy the world, and you will be in misery. When you're in the world, you'll be bugged because Jesus is in your heart. But when you're in church, it'll be boring because the world has taken over your soul. Don't do it. Be one way or the other. Get in, get out, be hot, be cold. That's the idea. And it goes on to say that if a man, verse 13, take a wife and go in unto her and hates her, and give occasions of speech against her or accusations against her, and bring up an evil name upon her, and say, I took this woman, and when I came to her, I found her to not be a virgin. Then shall the father, verse 15, of the damsel, the young lady, and the mother, take and bring forth the tokens of her virginity to the elders of the city. And the damsel's father, verse 16, shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man to be his wife, and he hates her. And he spoke in verse 17 against her, saying, I found not thy daughter to be a virgin. Yet these are the tokens, the proofs of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. And when the tokens or the proof of her virginity is seen, then they shall, verse 19, amends that man who made that accusation that she wasn't a virgin, 100 shekels of silver. And he's to give that. That's a chunk of change in that day. That's a lot of money. He's to give that money to the father of the damsel because of the accusation he brought against her. And then, verse 19 goes on to say, he cannot put away this wife that he was complaining about or saying wasn't a virgin. So it's interesting that there was to be a proof of a woman's virginity. And if a man said, well, I married her, but she's not a virgin. And dad and mom would then say, here's the tokens or the proof of her virginity. That man that made the accusation was to be dealt with severely, 100 shekels. And he couldn't get rid of her for the rest of his life. He was stuck with her, see. So even to this day, in Chicago and other places where you have ethnic neighborhoods in large cities, this tradition still goes on in a certain sense. And that is, after the wedding night, a parent will hang out the bed sheet of the daughter and of her husband to, if you would, signal the community by the marks on the sheet of the girl's, the young lady's virginity. And you say, man, that's brutal. Man, that's... But you see, if you grew up in that neighborhood and you knew that the tokens of your virginity were going to be displayed for the neighborhood, it would make you think twice, young lady, when some guy was trying to get you to compromise your morals and give in to his seductions. You would say, yeah, but... the whole neighborhood's going to know. The whole community's going to see. And it had a tremendous effect. It still does. And that's why, in again, ethnic communities in this country even, and certainly in Europe in certain parts to this day, they have these sheets that are flags or signs. My daughter truly was a virgin until the day of her marriage to this man, see. And... real incentive to stay pure. So in this case, it was the father's responsibility or the mother's responsibility to prove, my daughter is or was a virgin until the day that she was married, you see. And if this thing be true, though, verse 20, and she could not validate or verify her virginity, then that damsel was to be brought out of her father's house, verse 21, and she was to be stoned to death. Further incentive to stay pure, you see. Because if you weren't a virgin, my goodness, you would be in big trouble. It could be a real problem. And you, verse 21 goes on to say, shall put evil away from you. It's going to solve a problem of promiscuity, which will infect any culture that doesn't take these things seriously. And certainly we see that today, don't we? A culture where kids increasingly think it's normal and right to give themselves over sexually. God put some real heavy-duty standards and some real high expectations to protect people from what we see happen today. I was sharing on the air today in one African country in South Africa, Botswana, 50% of the people are HIV positive right now, today, 50%. Africa is being devastated. Lives are being ruined. A report came out today as well that they now know that the HIV virus, different than full-blown AIDS, but the one that causes, Scarposi? It causes that skin problem, that skin cancer. Now, according to the New England Medical Journal of recent days, it is now known to be passed not via intercourse, but via kissing. And so you see the results of this loose culture, the diseases and infections and heartbreaks and problems and deaths and devastations, not to mention what happens in the soul, which is the real issue. And we look at these things and say, well, this is awfully harsh, but we look and see what happens to people that ignore this, or a culture that puts this down as being archaic or unnecessary. And we see a culture contaminated and suffering and people unhappy and dying and problems. And I say that, hey, I would take this any day, actually. And that is where people say we need to have parameters and boundaries and standards. Important stuff. And it gets even more interesting. If, verse 22, a man be found lying with a woman married to a husband, then they shall both of them die, both the man that lay with the woman and the woman, and thou shalt put away this evil. In other words, if there is an adulterous intercourse situation, both the man and the woman are to be put to death. Well, that's not fair. Well, wait a minute. It's going to put down, it's going to control, it's going to eliminate to a great degree that problem from infecting a society. And the heartbreak and the pain that comes from adultery is awful. And God says, I want to nip this in the bud. Yeah, but they're stoned. Well, if they're believers, they go to heaven. See, it's not the end of the road for them. We have to put things in perspective, folks. We think, oh no, the worst thing that could happen is for a person to die. That's not the way God views it. That's not the worst thing that can happen to a person. In fact, it's really ultimately, if that person's headed for heaven, the best thing that could happen to a person. So people, how harsh God is. No, God's saying, I'm going to take them to heaven. But I'm going to keep this from spreading in the community, in the culture, in the nation, because it will spread if it's not dealt with severely. Now, you know the story. Jesus dealt with a woman caught in the very act of adultery. And they weren't after justice. They didn't care about the community, those guys that brought her to Jesus. Because if they did, they said, Master, we caught her in the very act of adultery. Well, the question would be, where is the man? Because the law declares here in verse 22 that both the man and the woman are to be dealt with. Which means that they weren't really interested in rightness and morality. They were interested in legalism and trapping Jesus, because if Jesus would say to the woman, stone her, then he would no longer be thought of as being the friend of sinners. If he said, let her go, they would say, you're violating the law of Moses, you know. So Jesus just said, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. They went their way. They knew they were guilty too. He wrote on the ground, John 8. Katagraphein is the Greek word. He wrote against them. Against who? Against the ones that had stones in their hands. What did he write? I think the Greek indicates, to me anyway, that he wrote against them. That is a name next to their names, or a hotel room, or a telephone number, a 900 number, or whatever it might be. And they realized, oh my, oh boy, we're guilty. And they dropped their rocks and they went their way. And Jesus said, I don't accuse you. Go your way and sin no more. How grateful I am for Jesus Christ. But how right are the standards of the law that people might be kept from heartbreak and heartache and that families might work in a culture? So consequently, both were to be stoned. If a damsel, verse 23, that is a virgin, be betrothed unto a husband, that she's engaged but not yet married, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, you shall bring them both out of the gate, you shall stone them with stones, that they die. The damsel, because she cried not out, being in the city, and the man, because he humbled his neighbor's wife or fiance, and you shall put this evil away from you. So if a betrothed woman, which means that she is formally engaged, considered to be married, but they're not yet living together, they haven't consummated the relationship, but they're legally married, but are not yet one. She's legally married, but she's not yet living with her husband. She's betrothed, as we've talked about previously. It's stronger than our engagement, but it's not coming together sexually yet. So a gal's betrothed and somebody lays with her. They're both to be dealt with. They're both to be taken out and they're both to be stoned. Now she might say, but I didn't want this to happen. He took advantage of me. No, she's to be stoned because she cried not out. Interesting. If she, being in the city, did not cry out, she's in the community, she's in the city, she's there in the city, she cried not out being in the city, then she's to be stoned too. In other words, she is to be held responsible too. Just like the man. Because she didn't do what she could have done. She's in the city. She didn't cry out. She allowed it to happen. And I say this, another controversial thing to think through. A lot of talk today, and we're hearing it here at the church even, about date rape. And you know what? A lot of times a girl will not cry out. And then she feels bad about what took place. And then she says, it's a date rape situation. In the Torah, in the law, if it's in the city, a damsel is expected to cry out. She's expected to get out of the situation by crying out because there are people all around. And if she doesn't do that, she's held responsible too, just like the man. And as a father of daughters, we need to tell our young gals this. I've talked to my daughters at various times about things like this. You're responsible. You are to be in the place where you can always cry out. And you see, you have a responsibility too. And I think in these days, it can be that we're not instructing our daughters properly by saying to them, you know what? You have got to be in situations, in places and locations where you can cry out and get out immediately. And if you allow yourself to not be in those situations, then you're asking for real problems, you see. One of the places that you can cry out is on a double date. You'll never be date raped, or I can't say that today, sad to say, but if you're double dating or group dating, so to speak, you're much less likely to be, quote, date raped. We got to teach our young women. The law says, God declared, hey, even if you were taken, you see, you didn't cry out. And because of that, you too are held responsible for the situation. Now, on the other hand, verse 25, If a man find a betrothed damsel in the field and force her, lie with her, then that man only, he shall die. But the damsel, unto her thou shalt do nothing. There is in the damsel no sin worthy of death. If a gal's in the field. Now that's where young women worked. They would do the harvesting of the wheat or the barley. And she's out there and she's working. And some guy is in the field and pops out of the field and grabs her and forces her. She's not held responsible in that situation. He's to be put to death. She's to be obviously exonerated because she couldn't control the situation. She wasn't out parking in some remote spot. She was working in the field. She was taken advantage of. And so consequently, because of that, you see, God says, no, she's not responsible. But on the other hand, in the city where she ought to be, in places of social interaction, that is, where there's people around, then she's held responsible along with the man. In the field where she's working away out there, doing her farm work as they did in those days, some guy attacks her there. In that case, obviously, the man is held responsible singularly. If a man, verse 28, find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, she's not engaged, she's not promised, if you would, and he lay hold on her and lie with her, and they be found, the man, verse 29, that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he humbled her in this way, and he may not put her away all his days. This is something we should teach our sons, fathers, pops, dads. If you lay with her, she's your wife. What? Yep. If you lay with a woman, you pay the dad of that daughter 50 shekels of silver. There's a price to pay. You got to pay up to her dad. And you took her as your wife. Well, I don't want to get married. What is marriage? It's a great question. What is marriage? See, our kids today think, well, marriage is when I put a tuxedo on and when I have a white dress and walk down the aisle and say I do. Well, I understand that thinking, but that's not necessarily the biblical basis of marriage. Adam and Eve didn't have tuxedos and gowns on. The two became one, and God called their name Adam. We need to teach our young people. You know what happens? When you lay with her, she's your wife. Well, I'm ready to get married. Well, Todd, you should have thought about that. You should know. And we ought to teach our sons, you're making a choice when you have intercourse with her, when you lay there by her, you are saying to her, you're my wife. In God's economy. Now, what would this do if people were taught this and told this? It would keep people from saying, man, who can I be with tonight? I mean, it alleviates and eliminates that kind of mindset. And I do tell my sons, you know what? If you take her out and you choose to do that, congratulations. You've chosen your wife. You've made your bed. Now sleep in it. Period. Oh, it's so harsh. It's so right. See, that's what God's word declares. And there's going to be a price to pay to her dad as well. There's going to be a price to pay, believe me. Very quickly, gets worse than that. He that is wounded in the stones, verse 1, or hath his privy member cut off, shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Oh man, why is this here? Well, simply to say, among other things, that in the congregation, God expects his people to be reproducing. I like that. A healthy congregation. Applegate Fellowship, in my opinion, is a very healthy congregation. Why? Because there's reproduction. Because people come here and get saved every single week. That's the most delightful thing. In the congregation, there ought to be reproduction. People witnessing and sharing and talking to others about Jesus. And they come out here. They're already ready to be baptized. We baptize 30, 40, 80 people on a Sunday. Each Sunday. What's going on there? It's people that are reproducers. They're healthy. That's the way it's supposed to be. Conversely, that's the way it will be for people that are in the congregation constantly. You can't help but talk about your faith. It's going to come up. There's going to be a witness shared if you're in the congregation, if you're in the house of the Lord. And a bastard shall not, verse 2, enter into the congregation even till the 10th generation. God has no illegitimate children. I like that. Well, yeah, but my great-great-granddad was a Methodist minister, so I guess that makes me part of God's kingdom. No, it doesn't. He doesn't have stepsons, foster kids, or illegitimate children. You must be born again. But as many as received him, to them gave he the power, the authority, to become what? The sons of God, even to those that believe on his name. But no bastards, no stepkids. No foster children. Just those that are born again, sons and daughters who believe on his name, being born again by believing in him. And then the Ammonite and the Moabite, verse 3 and 4, were not to be allowed into the congregation for 10 generations either because of the mean-spiritedness that they demonstrated when they gave not water nor bread to the people of God when they were in need coming out of Egypt that day. It says in verse 12, and we'll end here, thou shalt have a place also outside the camp where thou shalt go forth abroad. And thou shalt have a paddle upon thy weapon, and it shall be when thou wilt ease thyself abroad, thou shalt dig therewith, and shalt turn back and cover that which cometh out of thee. For, verse 14, the Lord thy God walks in the midst of thy camp to deliver thee and to give up thine enemies before thee. So therefore shall thy camp be holy, that he see no unclean thing in thee and turn away from thee. This was revolutionary. It was a whole new concept. It was an unknown thing in these times historically that when a man used the restroom, that he would actually go away from other people to do it. God says, when you need to ease yourself, I like that phraseology, go outside of the camp with a paddle, dig a hole, and do what needs to be done. Then cover it up. It's to be done outside the camp. Now keep in mind, the camp was large. Leave the camp. Leave the area. Go out there. That would be not necessarily real convenient for people. When I lived in Little Applegate, when I first moved up here, me and my wife Terry and Peter John, and we also had Jesse up there in a little A-frame. And the A-frame didn't have plumbing that worked. So we had an outhouse about, 150 feet or so, something like that, away up the hill. Outhouses are fine in the summertime, but in the winter they're slightly problematic for many reasons. But be that as it may, God was saying, I want you to go out of the house. You leave and you go out there. People culturally at this time, this was unknown. People just went wherever they wanted to go. It was no big thing at all. People didn't think like we do today. In fact, if you go with us to Israel, we go to a place called Beit She'an, which was a Roman city in Israel. Not a Jewish city, a Roman city. And they're rebuilding it out of the ruins of the earthquake that knocked the city down centuries and centuries and centuries ago. And it's becoming a marvelous sight. Every time we go over there, the restoration is just awesome. They're making it a whole Roman city using the rubble and piecing it back together piece by piece. It's phenomenal. You sit there in the big amphitheater and you walk down the Cardo, the main street, and the pillars. And one of the things they have there is the, at that time, this was in Jesus' day, at that time they got this advanced, the Roman pagan cultures. They did have a place to ease yourself for the whole city. It was one big room. And they have all these holes, and men and women, everybody, you go in there, and everybody uses the same place. There's no booths or walls, or everybody sits there. And the weird part, it gets real strange, because it was the social center of the city. So you would go in there, and you'd be sitting around with people, you know. Yeah, I know, but this is the truth. I mean, this is where Rome was at. This is what took place in pagan cities, even in sophisticated, fancy, uptown Roman cities in Jesus' day. And you'd sit there, and they actually delivered food in there. So you would sit there and have pizza or, you know, drink coffee, and men and women just sitting there on these big, long, long benches that faced each other, you know, and this is even the worst part. They didn't have tissue in those days. So they had, for each row, they didn't use tissue like we do. They used a stick, and they passed the stick down the row. That's the honest truth. I'm not kidding you. We'll take you there if we go to Israel. It's an amazing thing to see. Now you're saying, John, why are you telling us this? This is sick. Yeah, that's the point. What God says is, I want my people to be different than that. I want my people. Now, in these days, in Old Testament times, it was much more brutal than that. People just went wherever. You know, it was just like dogs do in our neighborhoods today. It wasn't even a thought. God says, no, not so with my people. I want you to go outside of the camp. I want you to dig a hole. I want you to bury it. And I want you to come back when you're done. Here's what I want you to see, though. And we'll be through, but it's important you understand. God says, and the reason is because I'm in the camp and I'm holy. Well, this is legalistic, they could say in that day. This is bizarre that we have to go out of the camp and dig a hole and cover it up again. God could have said, the reason is because there is bacteria and germs and the diseases that will spread through your community if you don't do this the way that I'm telling you to. Listen carefully. God did not give the reasons that we now know scientifically, we now know medically, we now know, of course this makes sense. If you don't have sanitation regulations like this, sickness spreads and disease spreads, and it's just a stinky situation. You don't want to do that. It's sick. There's problems and repercussions and diseases and all of that. But God says, you'll discover that centuries and centuries and centuries down the road. But more than my giving you a reason for it, I want you to learn to just trust me because I'm holy. I'm whole. I want you to be holy too. Because holiness leads to happiness. Why would he do this in this way? Why wouldn't he explain? People go out because if you don't, disease will creep in, bacteria will spread, germs will abound. God doesn't always give us understandings or reasons. Many times he does. Often he doesn't. Because he says, I want you, John, just to learn to obey me, even if it doesn't make sense to you or is understood by your culture at that time. It will be down the road. The culture will see. They'll read these scriptures, they'll read the word, and they'll say, the culture, that's dumb. how old and archaic and stupid. And down the road, though, they'll see, maybe that was pretty right and pretty wise. God wants me to be a child. God wants you to be a child. Even if you don't understand why the Word says what it says, even if you don't agree with what the Word is telling you, you say, nonetheless, you're holy. You're in the camp, and this is the way you want it. So even if I don't understand it or agree with it, I know that you are holy, you are happy. And you want holiness and happiness to be in me and in my family. Therefore, I will submit to it. And in due season, years later, or in heaven, I'll see the wisdom of it. God just says, do this because I'm in the camp. And this is the way I want it to be done. Centuries later, we say, of course. Obvious. But not these people. They had to take it at faith value and simply say, okay, we'll do it that way. May God help us to as well and save ourselves from unsanitary situations. And Father, lots of things in these passages to consider. Lord, you called us to be a different kind of people than the world says that people ought to be. And I thank you for it. Give us wisdom and help us, Lord, to be those children who trust you enough to do what you tell us to, even if we don't fully understand now. Lord, you've proven yourself to be right every time, ultimately. Now bless your people. Father, as these, your people, go their way, may they know that you are in the camp. May they acknowledge your presence and sense your touch and do the things that are right in your sight, that we too might prosper and be successful and be blessed in what we do with our children, with our spouses, with our community. I pray, Lord, that we would be holy. So, Father, we've taken in the scriptures, now apply it to our lives. May our souls be fed. May our walks be directed in the way that's right in your sight, in Jesus' name. Amen.